April 27th, 2008. It's the Watt from Pedro Show.
Thank you.
Watt from Pedro show. Got an interview with Stephen Droz of the Flaming Lips coming right up. Oh, we started the show off with Naima, Take 5, the fifth take off of Giant Steps, one of Stephen's favorite Coltrane songs. That was John Coltrane. And then we heard from the Flaming Lips, Riding to Work in the Year 2025. Now, this interview had to be done in two chunks because of things up with Stephen there. We did it on the phone over, he's in Oklahoma City, Oklahoma. And the first part was March 7, 2008, and second part April 21st, 2008. And you can tell the first part because there's more of a buzz on the line. I figured it out better. But without any more ado, here's Mr. Stephen Droz talking to me over the phone from where he lives to where I live here in Pedro.
So what's the deal with your spiel? What are we just rapping, huh?
Yeah, we're just rapping. Well, I wanted to go back. Oh, you know, I just came back from a tour.
Yeah.
Yeah. So this is...
Did you play... You, and when I say rock and roll mutant soldier, I mean, I really mean it because you... You're fucking living a life, man. Always.
I think
a lot of guys, like, I'm one of those guys who are like, all right, you know, you go out and tour for a while and you come home and you just shut down for a while. Do you do that ever? Do you ever just go home and do nothing for a while? Or are you always playing shows and stuff?
Well, I think SoCal is lucky that way. It's so spread out and you can play a lot of gigs here.
Yeah.
Without, what do they call it, saturating your draw.
That's what you mean, yeah.
Plus, I got a lot of different acts I perform in, so it makes
six right now,
something like that.
Yeah,
and
I'm
then
keeping track.
And then now with the Pro Tools, I can do things that you never do gigs. You just record with people.
Yeah, I love doing that. That's what I love to do.
Yeah, see, so you're doing music even when you're not tour.
Well, that's true. I mean, I'm always working on, you know, five different things. But, I mean, as far as going out and playing shows and, mingling with the people, with the rock and roll, other rock and roll mutants out there, I don't really do that so much, you know, like you do.
Well, I'm in my Pedro town, so I see them at the gigs and stuff. But most of my friends here, this is, you know, a working town, so most people don't play. There is a small punk scene now in Pedro, though, and one of my drummers is from that.
What do you mean punk scene? What do you mean by punk?
You know, God, they go on tours where they play people's houses. They don't even play clubs.
So you mean that? Okay, well, I understand that. That's cool. I didn't know if you meant like some sort of idealized retro, you know, this is the way it was in the late 70s, but not really, or if you meant like, oh, people are just literally playing people's houses.
Yeah, and they're young people, so for them it's kind of not retro, maybe. Somebody once told me the only thing new is you finding out about it.
There you go, man.
So, I was kind of...
Who said that?
I don't know who said that.
That's a really good... You should take credit for that.
No, I can't.
You know, Mike Watt, man, told me that... You know, I can be like, I'll be 80, you know, he told me the best quote ever. The only thing new is you finding out about it, which is, that's true.
Yeah, so for them, it's a kind of a, it's not a rehash, and they're starting their own bands, and I was kind of unaware of it. I was touring so much, but then, because there was never a punk scene in Pedro, when the Minutemen was around, we were the only cats. You know?
Well, sure, especially that early on, yeah, I can't even imagine what that must have been like.
So, yeah, most of the thing was up in Hollywood, which is 30 miles north, so... Like
when we talk about those times, I think you understand that, you know, you being in it and where I was at that same time were, you know, universes apart, because, you know, in 1979, I was 10, and I was playing on weekends at my dad's country band, playing drums in his country band, you know.
Oh, but you were playing. I wanted to get to that. How did you get started in music?
Well, my dad's a musician. He started playing saxophone and probably one of the very first, like, I would call it rock and roll bands in 1955. This band called Joey Long and the Wild Ones, and they were, you know, square as it was back then, with, you know, doing a, they were probably, well, they were doing you know, Jerry Lee Lewis covers, stuff like that. But it was pretty radical, you know, for backwoods country towns in the South in 1955, you know. 56, that's where he started.
And what was
he
playing?
He was a musician all his life, you know. I had my Kiss records and my Aerosmith, Led Zeppelin, whatever records when I was 6, 7, 8, and he got me a little, it was a very punk rock drum kit. It was just a bass drum, a snare drum, and a cymbal. And he's like, well, if you play for a while and show that you're interested, I'll get you some more drums. And, you know, a couple years later, I started playing in his band because I was just so obsessed with it, you know.
And what did he play?
He played saxophone, clarinet, and trumpet.
Oh, wow.
Which is weird that he played these instruments in a country band, but at that time they did country, but they also did, like, a lot of, you know, you call it sort of half-baked, light 70s rock, you know, stuff that I love, actually. You know, polkas and things like that. Just, you know, just big VFW party music is what they, a good time dance band, you know. So as you would say, got my chops playing that kind of stuff.
So
it wasn't about your own heart or being creative or anything. You were making a buck, you know, playing other people's music. That's
right.
The reality I knew first, you know, a few years I played music. I never dawned on me until, you know, I was like 13 or 14, you could actually write your own songs and stuff, you know what I mean? So.
But you were playing in your pop's band.
Yeah, yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
What were they called?
Terrible parenting, you know. Here I am, like a 10-year-old kid out these, because you played VFW halls on the other end of the spectrum, you know. VFW halls, they sound like this 10-year-old kid watching these, like, you know, middle-aged drunk people broke each other at 2 o'clock in the morning. It was kind of weird, you know.
What was the band called?
Well, it was his the band that sort of he was most known for was Vernon Dros and the Texas Brass. He was in that band. But the band that I joined playing, he was in this band called Rawhide. And, you know, it was cool because, you know, a lot of the music I love to this day, it was music that I heard playing that band. You know, everything from the good, you know, 60s and 70s Waylon Jennings stuff to, like, the really hokey stuff, like, you know, some Kenny Rogers late 70s stuff, you know.
Did he play drums?
What's that?
Did he play drums?
No, he didn't play drums.
So who taught you? You just self-learned?
Yeah. I guess it got to some point where I was, like, 6 or maybe I was 7, and I cut some, it sounds like something you'd hear, I don't know, it sounds like some made-up bullshit, but, I cut some branches off, or cut some sticks from a tree, and would just be walking around the house, beat on stuff. That's when he got the idea, like, I think I should check into this, you know. And so it just went from there, and I just taught myself. You know?
I heard Elvin Jones started banging on pots and pans to start.
What's that?
Elvin Jones.
Well,
Coltrane's drummer. He started by playing on pots and pans and shit.
I'm sure he did, man.
Then his sister loaned him some money to get a real drum set.
That's cool, man.
Yeah. Have you ever seen this?
I mean, it's one of those, it sounds like, you know, oh, yeah, that's a typical drummer story, but it is true. You know, I had my own homemade sticks, and I took, you know, my dad, he drove a beer truck for Miller at the time, and so I'd, you know, take the empty beer boxes he'd bring home and fashion them into some kind of drums, and I had some empty coffee cans. I had, like, a whole little kit there, you know. And that's when he's like, I guess I should get the kid a kit, you know. So got me the 3 drums, and there you go, I'm playing, you know. But I was...
Hello?
Man, I lost you there.
Yeah, the line went dead.
Really?
Yeah.
I thought maybe you got so bored you just hung up.
No fucking
way.
Yeah,
I don't want to get in all this.
No, I'm way into it. So how long do you play for your pop?
Well, that kind of went back and forth. I started playing when I was 10, and then, you know, we moved around a lot just because, I mean, you were a military kid, but my dad just changed jobs a lot for no real good reason, but, so we moved around a lot, but I would say I played drums in his band until I was about 13, and then I was playing another, like, country and, like, half-assed top 40 cover bands around town for a couple of years, and then when I played with him next, I was about 16. I was playing piano by that time. I was playing piano in a country band, and he joined that band. So,
wow! How did you get on piano?
I just got into it. You know, when I was about 12, I don't know. We had this cheap Yamaha organ at the house, and I've been looking at it for a couple of years. And one day, I fired it up and said, "Man, what's this all about?" I had a little cheap drum machine on it. And my dad still has it in his house. I still love that thing. But I don't know. I just wanted to learn how to, I wanted to see if I could figure out how some of that stuff worked, you know. Like, man, what are those you know, those chords and all that kind of stuff. What are they doing? What is that? You know, how does that work? And so, you know, I learned like Let It Be by the Beatles, you know, a couple of Journey songs, stuff like that. And it just...
On your own?
On my own, yeah. I never took any lessons.
Okay, well, are you ever playing with cats your own age yet?
Well, I was in a couple of garage bands, yeah. One was called, there was one, actually, this is a, you would love this story. The very first, like, garage band I was ever in was a band called Shadow Master. Shadow Master. And the leader of the band was this black guy named Andrew, and he was like 21. And this is when I was like 10 years old.
Damn.
And he drove like a Ford Econoline white, and he painted it with black paint, real cheap, like big, like Soul Brothers 70s, like calligraphy, Shadow Master. And he sang and played a Fender Precision Bass. And then he had this Mexican guy, Ray, who lived right down the street from me. He was like 18, real flashy guitar player. He played like a 335, and he could play like Van Halen licks and stuff like that. And that was the first band I was actually ever in. It was called Shadow Master.
Power Trio.
We were a Power Trio, and we played. Remember playing War Pigs a lot? We had that in Down pretty
well. 10 years old.
Yeah. I loved Black Sabbath since I was probably 6 or 7, you know, since I first.
Oh, man.
Started listening to music. I've always been a Sabbath fan. But we play, you know, Back in Black, AC/DC, stuff like that, you know. But, this one guy, he could play Eruption. But one cool story about Shadow Master was, and this is before, right, like a year or so before MTV, Andrew, the bass player guy, had taken War Pigs off Paranoid by Black Sabbath and synced it up to all this World War II footage he had, and it was on beta tape, and he had this beta VCR player thing. And this is before, you know, videos were actually something you could watch on TV on a regular basis, and all his friends would come over and they all smoke a bunch of pot. I didn't. I would just stand there and watch these, like, old kids smoke pot. He put on this War Pigs video and everyone would trip out on it. It's pretty cool. It's one of my fond memories about Shadow Master. So, when I was playing professionally with my dad, but I was also playing these garage bands with my brothers and his friends, you know.
And your drummer.
My brothers had friends that were all like stoner guys that play guitars, you know, equipment they stole from somebody. So
when did it dawn on you about writing songs, when you got into the piano?
Yeah, I would say that was when I first started to get the inkling of, like, well, you know, someone's got to make up something somehow, you know. But still, it was just something that was in the back of my mind. I think my whole trip was just trying to be, like, a good musician guy, you know.
Did you take music in school?
I did. I joined band in 8th grade because there was nothing else to do for that, like, extracurricular choices, you know.
Yeah.
And I just taught myself how to read. Music notation, just mainly percussion. I'm still a terrible reader. I would never choose to. I could more easily hear a piece of music, you know, even if it's like Mahler or something. I could hear it easier than I could read it and figure it out. So it's just more natural to me. You know?
So you're like in the marching band.
I was in the marching band, and see, 8th grade I played the snare drum. Then 9th grade I moved to high school, and I was still a little short. Short kid, I hadn't grown at all. I had to carry this big Musser marching xylophone. It was brutal, man.
Well, xylophone.
Yeah, I played xylophone, and then
that's
I
wild.
Played the tri-toms, and I moved up to snare drum again. So,
damn.
I actually liked marching band quite a bit. I thought it was kind of fun. But it seemed kind of just powerful sometimes. You know, if you're right in the right spot and you're playing the right piece of music, like, man, this is kind of powerful. It's fun, you know.
What was the first song you wrote?
First song I wrote. That's a really good question. Damn. I don't know. There's so many, like, you know. For you, the first song you wrote probably ended up on a record. It was like some definitive moment in your life.
I only wrote one song as a teenager.
Do you remember it?
Yeah, it was called Mr. Bass, King of Outer Space.
It was called what?
Mr. Bass, King of Outer Space. And it was about the bass player doing this big old solo that blew everyone off the stage.
Did you ever record that?
No, it's before punk.
I know. What's wrong with you? That should be recorded. You got to get together with, like, some of the stoner California guys, you know, like John Frusciante or something, you know. Get together with them, like Stephen Perkins, and record that, man. Make it a reality. You know? Come on, man.
Kind of wonder how it went. I just remember some of the words, you know. It was about, you know, it was obviously a big compensation for the inferiority complex, being put on bass.
That's fucking funny, man.
But that's the only song I wrote in my whole teen years.
Yeah.
Fucked up. It was a weird time in the 70s. People didn't write songs in our town. No one.
Well, that's because I remember, you know, when I first started to get to know you on that Chili Peppers tour back in 2003, you know, because I always would bend your ear about that. What was it like, you know? Your first concert was a T-Rex, right?
Yep.
You know, for me, I can't imagine something like that because that music, you know, is so lionized and, so, you know, there's such a reverence for it, from myself included, you know. Whereas my first concert, you know, I saw Yes, you know, the 1995 tour. You know, it's not nearly as cool. You know, it meant a lot to me, and it still does, but it's not nearly as cool as seeing T-Rex as your first concert, you know. But I try to imagine that you say that now. People weren't writing songs, you know.
No.
Wayne's tried to explain that to me. Like, in the 70s, there was no, like, hey, I could be that guy, you know. There was just, there's Jimmy Page up on the stage, and I'll never do something like that, you know.
Yeah, it was a weird time. And then these guys who didn't even know how to play were writing their own songs, and that's what really attracted us to the punk movement. We couldn't believe they had the nerve. Well, the whole idea of playing as a means of expression and not just trying to copy a song off a record. You know,
that was a big step.
The other way was more like building models or something. Kind of looks like the real thing. But it was nothing about your own thoughts or feelings or, you know.
I understand that, yeah. I think for me it's like, because I started out just copying everybody else, because for me it was important how you're supposed to do it in the first place.
Yeah.
Which for me, that was my trip, you know. For you guys, it was like you said, you thought, oh, you just tune your strings to whatever feels good.
Yeah.
You didn't even know there were some rules you're supposed to adhere to.
No. We thought if you played down on the corner,
know what the rules were, and then try to figure out what the rules were and learn them, and then like, oh, then you can work outside these rules, you know. But
yeah, that's how you're supposed to do it, huh?
Not necessarily. I just love that. Like, we just tune these strings, whatever.
We thought it was a personal thing. I like them loose. I like them tight. We didn't equate it with pitch.
Or like, oh, you seem like the kind of guy who would have loose strings.
Yeah.
You seem a little tight. So. To me,
we thought if you played down on the corner and it sounded right, then you were in tune. We didn't know your down on the corner had to be like the other guy's down on the corner.
Yeah, which it's almost like my oldest brother, you know, he couldn't, you know, I was waiting to kiss from like the age of 6 to about 9, you know. And, you know, he had an acoustic guitar, and he could play a couple of chords and play a couple of little riffs here and there. And he couldn't figure out the riff for Black Diamond. And I used to razz him about it. I'm like, what the hell? Why can't you play Black Diamond, you know? And he told me because the guys in Kiss had special machines on their guitar that allowed them to play Black Diamond.
I
so
saw
when you're a kid, you're like, okay, I guess that's just the way it is.
Yeah, we thought fuzz tones and all those sounds on the records was some studio tricks. We didn't know about pedals. They could not get that sound with those little
how
amps.
How would you know unless someone told you or you saw it like in a pawn shop or some music store or something? You know?
Didn't know. And I remember when we saw Fuzz Face, those round things.
Yeah.
And it was like, sound. It was so trippy.
I just got a couple of weeks ago. I'm really, man, you know, because I'm always on the lookout for the best fuzz pedal of all time. I don't know if you've ever come across a Fuzz Rite by, you know, Most Rite made stomp boxes in the late 60s.
Whoa.
You know, Most Rite has this pedal called the Fuzz Rite. Supposedly like Jefferson Airplane. I've even read like the Stooges used them on the second record. You should ask those guys if they ever used the Fuzz Rite by Most Rite, because I got this thing.
It was called the Fuzz Rite?
It's called the Fuzz Rite by Most Rite.
Okay.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Ask Ashton if he knows anything about it.
I will tomorrow.
What's that?
I will tomorrow. I know he used a Fuzz Face.
Man, it's fucking vicious. It's like, it sounds like it could be something off Funhouse. The guitar solo on Down the Street.
Oh.
It has that kind of sound to it. You should ask him if it's that pedal, because it's, man, it's just a wicked fuzz pedal. I've bought at least 20, like, vintage of the old style guys in the last 2 years, and this is the most badass one I've come across. It's really something special.
Wow. You know, a lot of the kids now, a young band, you'll see they'll have all kinds of pedals.
Yeah.
It it's a real common thing now.
Which is cool. I think it's wonderful.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Music. Watch fucking Jay Maskus, man. He's just like a master of all that shit.
And Nels Klein, he does a dance.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. I try to keep it simple live, but...
I don't use any of that stuff.
Extensive pedal collection at this point, but... I don't know, so let me ask, what was the first, like, stomp box you ever bought?
Man, I don't know, because I didn't really... I seemed to, like, cut the low end on the bass using those things. I think it was one of them Bootsy Trips envelope filters.
Really? I guess
yeah,
cute. I'm trying to, like, imagine you with, like a Mutron, like
yeah,
Mutron 3 or something, yeah.
Yeah, and I tried it. I didn't really use it for gigs.
Yeah, it's like anything. Too disco for you guys.
You
know... So, after the fucking Telecaster singing his heart on, you're over there doing the
Yeah, so I didn't really use them with. I tried with this Sickness Opera a few years ago. I tried using effects because I had a. It was an organ bass drum. You saw us the second.
Well, yeah, we toured with you guys. Yeah,
that's right. And so I thought, well, Pete could hold the low end down with the left hand because it can go down to C. It can even go lower than me. So.
Yeah. Yeah.
So that's when I tried it. But then, man, it's like hitting them at the right time and carrying them around. And I just, after that opera, I stopped using them.
Well, I mean, I disagree with you, but I understand your point. It's like it's somewhere else. It's another cerebral element you have to be in control of, you know what I mean?
Yeah, too hard for Watt, not for most people.
It's like what you're wanting to do is just like, you want to get just the pure raw emotion and not even be thinking about what you're doing. That's really hard to achieve anyway in the best of circumstances. So
yeah.
Having a bunch of pedals you got to be in control of just makes it even worse. You know?
I used to see Michael play like Wow Wow and stuff on his bass. And,
yeah.
Oh yeah, let's get to that. When did you meet them? Because you can't remember your first song you wrote, but
I can't.
You started writing songs and you're playing piano. But when do you meet these Michael and Wayne?
We have to talk for a long time. Because I've met those guys. That's why I sort of already got on the path of hoping to meet some rock and roll mutants that were making their own weird noise or whatever, you know. And I discovered, you know, Sonic Youth and all the bands that made that big impact on me when I was like 19 and 20. And the Flaming Lips from one of those bands. I didn't really like their early stuff that much, but I heard, you know, that record in the Pre-Straight Ambulance came out, and that was the one that fucking bent my ear for sure. I'm like, damn, what the fuck are these guys doing? You know?
Oh, so you didn't know them in school?
No. I mean, those guys are a lot older than me. Wayne is, 8 years older than me. Michael's 6 years older. So I just happened to move to Norman, Oklahoma, with another band that I joined in Austin, and I moved to Norman. And then this band wasn't working out that I was in, so I was just washing dishes at this place in town and didn't really know what I was going to do. And I just stand at this guy's house who had like an 8-track where the Lips had done some demos for that Hit to Death record. And I just happened to meet Wayne randomly one day. We just started talking, and yeah, I didn't tell him that, you know, love the Flaming Lips and all that kind of stuff. I just was sitting there talking to him, and he just seemed like one of my older brothers or something. He seemed real cool. That was cool, man. And then I met him like 2 weeks later again at the same house, and Nathan, their drummer for the previous two records, had just quit. And between the time he'd met me before and this next time, he'd seen a videotape of me playing with this band that I had been in. And he kind of asked me on the spot, like, hey, man, our drummer just quit. You want to come up to Oklahoma City and set up some drums with us and just play through some stuff? And that was September of 91.
So, wow.
And then I was just in the band, and that was, what, 16 years ago or something, 17 years ago, whatever it is.
So were you touring with that Texas band?
We did, like, two little tours, yeah. This band called Janus 18. And these guys, I mean, you had been in the scene for so long anyway, but for me at that time, I was just trying to find anybody that wasn't playing metal or some bullshit, you know?
Yeah.
Which to me was like, man, that's one thing I cannot deal with, you know? But these guys were all younger than me, so like probably for the first time in my life, I was actually playing with a bunch of guys younger than me. So these guys were all like 19 and 20, writing their own songs and, you know, doing like a kind of a Nirvana, Lips, Dinosaur Jr. kind of trip, you know, which is actually pretty hip for a bunch of guys who were 19 and 20, you know.
Yeah.
And they had a tour of the Midwest book, and they really wanted to try to do something, you know. So I was into that, so I ended up joining that band, and that band was going nowhere. So I ended up in Norman, Oklahoma, where they were from, and that's how that all happened. You know?
But that was like the first touring band, Janis 18.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
And your drummer?
You know, not literally playing people's houses, but, you know, close enough. You know, you play to five people at the fucking, trying to think, you know, Gabe's Oasis in Iowa City or something. You know that place, don't you?
I've played there many times.
I played this. What was the place in Madison? It was called Madison, Wisconsin.
Madison, I played a bunch of times.
O.K.'s Corral,
yeah. Right. Tom Late.
So, see, when I played there in 1990, it was a new thing. You'd probably already played there like 25 times in your life.
Yeah, it ended up burning down.
I heard about that.
Yeah. So there's a new O.K.'s now. It's not as good as the old one.
Sure it's not, yeah.
It's kind of like a sports bar.
Hey, Watt, I'm sorry to do this to you, but I got to put my boy down to bed, man. Can we continue this later or something?
Yeah, of course.
This is fun, though. Why don't we do this, like, when we were just sitting around drinking Jim Beam?
Because I'm in Pedro. I mean, I guess I could get a bottle. You could have a bottle.
I'm going to work on that. Yeah, it was funny when you came to see us with Sonic Youth up in Detroit.
Oh, man.
And the only person I've ever seen grab a bottle of whiskey like that is myself. Where you just grab it and you play like four gloves. Man, I'm fucking talking about the Stooges, man. Fuck. You remember that?
Yeah.
Calm down, man.
There was a lot of pressure on me. That was a big relief valve.
Yeah, you were naturally jacked up for sure. I could feel it, man. You walked through the room and it was like the energy level just went, suddenly
I just spent
out of control.
8 days with them. Three of them with Iggy alone.
I gotta go, but I want to ask before we part ways for now, at least.
Okay.
We're gonna continue this conversation, but have you got to a point with him where you're just comfortable hanging out with him, or do you still feel like, is there like a worship thing happening with that, or? God damn it.
It's Watt calling you, Steve.
God damn it, Watt. What's going on?
Dude. I got some fucking hell news in a little bit. When we did our last spiel, the battery in my lap purse, shorted out, and I lost that file.
Man, you gotta get that shit together.
Well, Apple gave me a new battery. It was just a fucked up one. They're made of many cells, and just one cell goes out.
Damn.
But what we were talking about was you getting into the band with the lip people. And moving from drummer
to Oklahoma and stuff. And moving from drummer to.
You moving from Texas to Oklahoma.
Yeah, and then getting in the band and evolving all that kind of stuff. Yeah.
Right. Right.
Well, shit.
So just pick up on that, and you can paraphrase it, chop it up into little tininess as much as you want.
Well. I thought we were going to talk about something else. Though.
We are, but just because I lost that file. I've never had a problem with the Mac before, but it was a bad battery.
I got you, right.
So, I got dealt the hand.
Well, you got to forgive me a little bit because I'm pretty exhausted, pretty tired, and I just felt bad that I've been, hadn't responded to you on MySpace and all that.
Well, that being the big gatekeeper of all connects should probably be kind of weird. But if you want to do this tomorrow, I could do it tomorrow.
No, let's do it tonight.
Right?
Yeah, I'm tired and stuff, but yeah, shit, we'll just
What happened? You were like discussing how Cliff came in as a helper man, and you were still playing on the record, but for the gigs.
We were talking about all that stuff.
Yeah.
Well, I think we were backtracking to when I actually joined the band, When,
you were playing with these Dallas cats.
Yeah, these guys from Austin and Dallas. That was this band called Janis 18. I was playing with them. And we were living in Austin, and things just weren't working out for them, for us, whatever. So they moved back to Oklahoma, so I moved with them. And moved back here and just kind of hanging out. And that same time. You know, Nathan, the drummer for the Flaming Lips, quit that same time.
Right.
And so Wayne, you know, Wayne came over to where I was living, because it was a, the guy I was living with had a little studio there, and they'd done some recording. The Lips had done some recording there, so yeah, he came over and had seen a video of me playing drums with those guys.
That's all he saw was a video. He hadn't seen you play with Janis 18.
Right, exactly. Yeah, he just saw this video. And we just started talking, and you know, within a couple of minutes, it was just very comfortable. He seemed like an older brother or something, you know?
Right.
I mean, a lot of guys I meet playing in bands and stuff just seem, you know, like older brothers or whatever. You know, like you. You're just, to me, you're like an older brother that I wish, you know, my older brothers would have taken your path or something, you know? Well, you know what I mean?
Yeah, that's very kind of you.
You know, playing music and doing your own thing and stuff like that. And so Wayne kind of, to me, was that sort of guy. And, of course, I was a big Lips fan at that point.
So you never knew him as Luigi?
What's that?
You never knew him as Luigi?
No, that was way before my time. Okay. That was in his fast food service industry.
Because you know about us, when we first met him and conked at his pad, or maybe the first couple of years we knew him, we thought that was his name.
He told me that, and you told me that too. Yeah, pretty funny.
And we knew him as artist. He had all this artwork. We didn't know he had a band.
That's so funny, man.
Yeah.
I know, because, you know, the thing about Wayne is he's always been making his own deal, you know?
Yeah.
Since he was, I think probably since he was like 10 years old, he's always been doing his own kind of trip, you know? Which is very admirable.
Yeah.
Saturday night, we actually watched the Christmas on Mars movie. We watched it at his house, but in this big circus tent that he sort of created to play at the festivals. Like, it's Sasquatch that's going to show that big music festival in Washington.
Yeah.
Called Sasquatch. It's going to show there. We're going to have this big circus tent that basically Wayne has sort of set up and created with a five, you know, surround sound PA system and stuff like that. So, but yeah, going back to the story.
Yeah.
You know, he came over, we started talking, and within a couple of minutes, I felt, I don't know, it's a very comfortable feeling, like talking to my brother or, you know, someone in my family, because our families are kind of similar, too, in our upbringing and how big our families are and stuff.
His pop did music?
No, his pop didn't do music. No, his pop, just a hard-working, I don't know, just a hard scrabble guy from Pennsylvania. That's where they were from originally. He was from Pittsburgh. But, I don't know, just, you know, there's six kids in his family, five kids in my family.
Oh, yeah, big one.
You know, half Irish, half Polish or Slavic. Wayne's mom is Polish. My dad, obviously, he's Czech, you know. And my mom is Irish, and his dad was Irish, so.
Oh, yeah, Celtic, Slav. Yeah. We got a lot of Slavs in Pedro.
What's that?
We got a lot of Slavs in Pedro.
There you go, yeah.
Croatia.
There you go, yeah. So, you know, so we had, you know, I don't know, it's just kind of similar. The first one went to his dad, to his folks' house. I, you know, felt like I was, like, hanging out with cousins or something. You know, it was very comfortable. But, yeah, but he asked me to, come, you know, come play some drums with him and try out. Not try out, but, you know, jam or whatever you want to call it.
All right.
Of course, I know a bunch of Lip songs already, so we set this drum kit they had. Pretty nice drum kit, and Ivan's just throwing down the bass, and Wayne was playing some guitar, and I was playing some drums, and it was great, yeah. And what's the point of the story? And then I was just in the band.
Right, and you start touring with him.
Start touring them like 3 or 4 months later, and then we're just doing the thing, you know, and then from my perspective, I'm, you know, these guys are older, and I'm...
Right.
I guess I was 22 at that point, 22, and like, shit, you know.
What's the first recording you do with him?
We did a couple of weird B-side things. We had to cover Ballrooms of Mars by T-Rex.
Yeah, I know that one, Slider.
Yeah, fucking awesome song.
T-Rex, my first gig, you know.
I know, we talked about that. Your first concert was fucking T-Rex. I'm like, how cool is that? that tells you right there how much older you are than I am.
Thank you.
Thank you. But so we did a cover of that for like a weird Warner Bros. B side. Well, you know, the first real recordings we did was for that the Transmissions from the Satellite Heart album.
And oh, yeah.
By then, I was, you know, pretty comfortable. Wayne and I were actually even writing songs at that point together. And, you know, it just, I don't know, it just very comfortably evolved from that point. You know, it was never, I think the Flame Lips were always like, they never, it wasn't like each person had one certain job they did, you know.
Right.
A lot of bands are like that, and it's just the way it is, which is fine, you know. And Led Zeppelin, you know, John Bonham plays the drums, and Robert Plant sings, you know, Page plays guitar, you know. With the Lips, it was always like, I think the drummer played some piano, and, you know, Michael would do weird, you know, whatever it was, you know.
Right.
So when I joined the band and started recording with them, we just, whoever had a part, we just played a part. So, and it was very comfortable. It was no big deal. And, you know, that was just, that's been my reality since I was 22, was being in the Flaming Lips. You know?
Right. But the change comes where you leave the drums for the gigs.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, only because, you know, we'd made that record, The Soft Bulletin, and Ronald, our guitar player, had quit.
Right.
And we just didn't know how we were going to present the show. It was like, well, I could play drums, and we could have a bunch of other people hire these people to play these other parts that I played on the record, or we could just put the drums on a tape, which is what we did, and I would just play this other stuff live, guitar and keyboards, and sing backing vocals and stuff like that. And so that's what we were doing for, you know, when we started doing that in 1999, it was kind of it seemed like a novel idea. It seemed like an interesting thing. Now it's no big deal. You see bands all the time where there's three people playing, and they got a whole backing track thing going, there's video stuff going on, you know what I mean?
Yeah, the Go Team had the horns. And
mm-hmm. Yeah, well, that band's an extreme example, because there's a lot of people playing, but there's also a lot of stuff that's like backing track stuff, you know?
Right.
It's just a big wash of sound. You know?
That's really foreign. That shows my age big time.
What's that?
That shows my age big time, because I haven't really done that.
Well, I mean, you know, it's kind of, you do it out of necessity in some ways. You know, if you made a record where Watt was doing a bunch of stuff with orchestra or whatever, keyboards and choirs and shit like that, and you had to recreate it live, well, you'd have two options. You'd either do it and hire a bunch of people live, or you just put on a tape and have a tape play, you know.
Yeah, not enough room in the boat. I'd go for the tape.
Yeah.
You know, I just made a record.
Yeah.
With Nels.
Man, I saw some video footage of that.
Really?
That fucker's crazy, man.
Yeah.
How'd that go?
I did it. You know, I still got to put some singing and mix it, but he's in. Yeah, well, he's sensei big time. You know, you don't even have to use music. You could use food words. And he translates it and makes it six string. Oh, well, he played 12 string on every song too, and electric sitar.
Nice.
So I asked him, Nels, please play your most psychedelic you ever done.
Yeah.
Yeah. And man, he did the pedal dance, big time, in real time.
In real time.
Yeah, you know, it's pretty much of it. I think maybe what you saw was like the tail end of a jam.
What I saw was him playing lightning fast flurries of weird distorted sound.
And like, the rhythm section just in one groove thing, right?
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
So, like, when you're making records, you know, with the Minutemen, it'd be one thing, but when you're making records now...
Yeah.
Like, you're recording, you're there for the recording, you're in charge and stuff. How involved are you with the mixing and stuff like that?
Yeah, I'm pretty... I don't have my hands on the knobs.
But you're there saying, here's what...
Yeah. I'm asking... It's almost like what I'm asking Nels to do. Help me realize this, but you know the guitar.
Yeah.
So I'm feeding them concepts, but those... the knob man, Jimmy, he's... make it, or whoever the engineer is this time is... Yeah. He knows his machine, and so I trust him.
Well, that's the way you have to work. You know?
So like a motor and a transmission, and... You know, he's got to get the shit to the wheels.
I know, I'm kind of struggling with that right now because I'm doing this music for this documentary that's coming out. And, you know, I can play instruments, you know, whatever. I can write melodies and songs and play different things. But as far as, you know, the technicality of mixing music, I don't do that worth a shit.
Yeah, I don't trust in a lot of ways, but...
Yeah. I'm the same way. It's like I need someone to just come in here, and I say, okay, make the drums sound like this, make the bass sound like this.
Yeah.
Whatever. But
right.
For me, I can't technically do it very well. It always sounds like mush, and it's a tough thing. So.
Yeah, I'm in your boat with that.
Okay, we're in the same boat then.
Yeah, because I think I'm too close to my machine, and I don't get enough perspective, and I don't really know the boards, you know, how to get those things.
No, that's a different...
I think you have to spend time at it, yeah.
That's something to be respected, I think.
Totally, just like a cat playing.
Yeah, I agree, absolutely.
So, yeah.
And I've over the many years I've recorded the Flaming Lips, we've always had Dave Fridman with us, who I think is... I don't know, he's just the master. You know?
Yeah, he's bad.
He's he's just the best. So when you're used to working in that environment, when you don't have to, you just set up your guitar and start playing, and you know it's going to be recorded in the best possible way.
Yeah.
When I get home, I try to record some guitar, it's like, this sounds like shit. You know? The amp sounds good, the guitar sounds good, but when I put it to tape or whatever you want to call it, hard drive, it just sounds like crap, and it's really a struggle.
Right, right.
I'm kind of going through that phase right now. Like, damn, how can I figure this out on my own? But
you build relationships, you know, just like trying to be a one-man. Nels, a couple days ago, just did a one-man guitar album.
Yeah.
It's all guitar and, man, intense. The focus, the last session I did with him a couple days ago, 12 hours straight. And the guy just, you know, he's got... He's something else.
It's a music machine.
Yeah, pretty lucky.
That's a good deal, man.
I am pretty lucky. Yeah, totally good deal.
But you do a lot of stuff, man. I, like, you know, every day on MySpace, I'm like, oh, what's Watt up to today, you know? I mean, it's not that it's weird. It's just that, because my gig right now is I'm just home with the family, you know, so the Lips aren't going to start touring again until, I think, June or something like that.
All right.
And then we'll just be touring, you know. While I'm home, I'm recording at home and stuff, but I'm not going out every night playing gigs and stuff, but it seems like that's what you're doing.
Yeah, well, I think part of it's SoCal, and it being spread out, you can play a lot of pads without saturating the one dealio like maybe other towns.
That's what it seems like.
Yeah.
It seems like every night you're doing, you got Banyan, you got...
Miss and Men last night.
So that's Stephen Perkins, right?
Banyan's Perkins, yeah. I played with him in San Francisco. Yeah, I just did 4 gigs with him. And Nels was on board.
How's he doing?
Yeah, he's happening. He was in some band he just let go of with Navarro.
Oh, Navarro, yeah.
Right.
The horror of the rock scene, I think.
Yeah, well, maybe less music and more other things, like reality television, radio, or...
Sure, yeah.
Yeah, so he's branched off.
Yeah, he's doing all kinds of stuff, yeah.
Right, so that band's done. Now Perks, he does a lot of Banyan without me and Nels, because we can't be there for a lot of gigs. Especially
well,
on the...
You got Stooges, you got Watt, you got whatever.
Right, and the Missing Men I played last night. I got Second Men, I got Dose gigs coming up. I've had Dose almost 23 years now. That's my...
Tell me, what exactly is the deal with Dose?
It's two basses.
I know, but what else is the lineup?
That's it.
There's no drums or anything?
No.
I didn't know that.
It's pretty Kano.
Oh, I thought it was like you and...
Kay from Black Flag.
Sorry, I'm being slow here, buddy. I'm tired.
No, it's okay.
I thought it was like a drummer and a guitar player, but it's
no.
Just you two guys?
It's just big.
You and the gal.
And we got just done a 4th album. I should flow them to you because it is kind of weird music.
What would you liken it to? I mean, if you had to describe it.
Yeah, I wonder. Because it's kind of like a total, for a bass player, indulgent thing where you just, because you're the frequency so narrow for the bass, you really have to play the holes or you step all over each other, so it's a challenge really in composition.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
So it's kind of ping pong. It's not one person playing lead and the other one playing rhythm so much. It's like letting holes for each other and passing the ball around.
It sounds kind of cool.
Oh, well, yeah, I should flow you some. But we've been doing it for many years. I mean, we come from the older days, you know, before punk bass players in rock and roll were really looked down on, you know, as like, you know, the right field or where you put the retarded friend. And
I guess.
Punk really equaled things out because, you know, everybody was lame, so the bass player was on the same level.
Did you think
that? Well, my experience, the arena rock days, you listen to those records, no, bass players were respected, but for some reason, people playing in the garages, no one wanted to play bass. And then guys who ended up on bass were ones, because there were so many guitar players, they want to get the gigs. And of course, there's the one guy in high school who was on the stand-up in the school band. But like nobody, not like what Les Claypool and Flea did, and like make young people, that's the first instrument they want to do. That's more a newer thing, last 20 years or something. So out of that insecurity, you know, we wanted a band with no competition. You know, because there was this fucking hierarchy thing, you know, and although, you know, the mission of the bass to be a foundation for a band is very important. And
absolutely,
yeah. You know, in a lot of ways, bass is felt more than it's heard. It's politically, it's very interesting instrument in a band, but I don't know. It was just a whim, you know. And then we just chased it down. She's got incredible work ethic, and I tried to focus to it, and went on it.
Yeah.
And none of it's really wasted because
your personal relationship.
Oh well, we used to be married.
But you're not anymore.
Maybe for 16 years.
Man, I don't know this. I'm so sorry. I should know.
That's why I had you on the radio show, so people can know about this.
Get more information about it before we actually had this phone conversation.
No, it's all right. People can know. You know,
I thought you guys were still together.
We are, but married to music.
But not magically.
No. Not like that. But, man, she is tight buddy with me. Believe me.
I'm sure anyone you know is a close friend of yours. You know?
Well, you know how some marriages...
20 years or something, you know.
Right, but some marriages, people get bitter on each other, but not with this one.
I like to hear that's good. You know, me and my wife had the same thing. We were together for about 6 years, and then we broke up in 1997 and remained friends for many years, you know. And then I was going through all my drug bullshit. And then I got off the opiate stuff in 2001, and we sort of gravitated back towards each other and got married in 2004, and now we got two kids.
Yeah, right. So. There's some of that in the Freak movie.
What's that?
The Fearless Freak. Freaks. A little bit. What'd you think of that movie?
I think some of it's kind of cheap, but... I think it kind of tells the story. You know? I think the great thing about the movie is that you really sympathize with the characters. You know what I mean? It's not so much like an overview of here's what happened with the band. It's like you kind of get sucked in personally with the guys in the band, which I think is a great thing.
Yeah, that's what I thought. It was a human story, big time.
Yeah, and that's the good thing about it. So, I got no problem with it. Bradley, the guy that made the film, I love that guy.
What I was going to ask you. You guys didn't really make it. Another cat made it.
Well, it's a documentary about us.
Right. So. And from another perspective.
Yeah, but he's pretty close with us. He has been for years. And he's been making videos with Wayne since 92 or something like that. So
he had good insight.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah.
Now, I haven't seen it in a while, but yeah, sure.
Vis-a-vis that in the Christmas on Mars. Now that's an in-house, that's a Lips thing.
Yeah, that's a Wayne Coyne production there.
Right. Wayne Coyne production, but you have a pretty major role.
Well, because we're the main protagonist character in the film, yeah.
Because they kind of touch on that in that film too.
Yeah, exactly, yeah. So I'm sort of the main, I guess the main character in some ways, but not really, because I'm not really... how do I say it? I'm not really the star of the show. It's the film. It's very weird. It's like, you know, have you ever seen Eraserhead?
Oh yeah, I love it.
I wouldn't want to compare this film to Eraserhead, but I would in the way that you know, the main character of Eraserhead, which is, what's the actor's name, Jack Nance or something?
Yeah, he looked like Jack Brewer.
He was friend of David Lynch, and Lynch got to do this part. He ended up being in most of David Lynch's films, but, you know, he's not really a star, but he's the guy you see mostly, you know, and he's just kind of walking around looking weird. But
right.
But Christmas on Mars does have a plot, but it's not really cut and dry as to... It's not a traditional film in that way. Really, say I'm the star of the show, but I'm sort of the main character that you're sort of following around and watching what he's dealing with.
Sort of like, yeah, David and Racer. What did you get from Racerhead? I'm interested. I did get kind of a message.
I didn't get a message.
April 27, 2008. It's the second hour of the Watt from Pedro show, and we continue with the March 7 and April 21st, 2008 interviews with Stephen Drodes of The Flame and Lips. That was conducted by myself here in Pedro over the phone with him in Oklahoma City, Oklahoma.
What I got from it was like, no matter how, like a ball bearing from a distance looks so smooth, but you get close enough and there's going to be divots and filth and everything is porous. Nothing is a smooth surface.
I can see that, yeah.
You know, when he looks in the radiator and all the little filth in there and the little... That's what I got from it, in a way, that the idea of kind of making fun of a 50s idea of suburbia and everything is packaged and together and everything, but the dirt behind the daydream, yeah, that's just it, the dirt behind the daydream.
Well, that's probably more than the film's actually worth, actually. No, I didn't mean it that way. It's just, you know, to me, it's just visually a, you know, I don't get an emotional response from it or anything. But
what about that music?
Yeah, that's...
That cat who made that music, he had some show here called New Wave Theater on a cable channel, and Minuteman, Black Flag were on it. He ended up getting strangled to death.
Really?
Yeah, I was just now trying to think of his name, but he made a New Wave album. He was kind of in the business or the racket somehow, but yeah, it was horrible how he was murdered. I don't think it was ever solved.
Well, didn't the Jack Nance guy die a mysterious death, too?
Yeah.
The actor from Eraserhead, the main guy?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So maybe it's jinxed. But that music was so bizarre. I saw that in the 70s, you know.
Well, see, you saw it when you were supposed to see it. I saw it in high school, like in 1986 or something like that.
Okay.
You know what I mean? I don't know. I like some David Lynch films, but my favorite is actually Elephant Man. I don't know if you've seen that one.
Yeah. Hurt.
It's a powerful movie.
John Hurt, I think, is...
John Hurt, yeah.
Is the dude. Right. Yeah, I think I saw it in the late 70s or early 80s, Eraserhead. And it was one of those things, like with Warhol films and John Waters at midnight and the art house kind of trip. Because during my 30s, I didn't see any movies. But in my 20s, I saw a lot of these, what I would kind of equal to punk or something. And not Mersch movies.
Yeah, again, this is like an age thing where, you know, all the things you were living through, I kind of missed out on. I mean, imagine when you were starting the Minutemen with fucking D. Boone and Shirley and all that shit. I was in fifth grade, you know. From your perspective here.
I know, but it's just circumstance. You got a pretty wide knowledge of avant-garde and stuff, and it shows in your music and stuff. And then also me and D. Boone weren't playing with our pop at 6 years old. I mean, what kind of advantage do you have on us that way?
Well, that's true, I guess, yeah.
So circumstance puts us in different places.
Yeah, but you were always coming from a perspective of creating your own thing from scratch. And that's why I have so much respect for you and all of that stuff, from you to fucking, you know, Thurston Moore to whoever, you know. And Henry Rollins or whatever, you know, it's like Wayne Coyne, all those people. It's like, to me, that's a league of people that started their own thing from scratch and had no idea what was really out there, you know, just starting your own thing.
Yeah.
Whereas for me, I came from my background was like I was just an entertainer playing jobs on the weekends with my dad.
Yeah, right. But there was a music part to it.
Yeah, but still, you know, you see what I'm saying? That's the art.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, because I think it's where we were at that point in time. That was the situation. You know, punk had to come out of this thing that people had forgotten. I actually think it was a rebirth of probably some 60s experiments.
I'm sure, yeah. Yeah. I'm sure. Like, just some people bored and disillusioned with what was going on. Like, fuck, let's just try to create something, you know, for ourselves.
Yeah, a lot of it, I think, was kind of even a reaction against arena rock.
I know we keep talking about that, and it's funny because you were talking about Peter Frampton.
In the kimono.
Like you do, motherfucker. You know? And that cracked me up because actually, between you and me, and I guess your radio broadcast or whatever it is, I kind of like that song, actually. Just because to me, it paints this picture, because I wasn't there when it was happening, you know. To me, it paints this picture of, like, everything's cool, man. This is cool.
I know. Then some idiot sees it as a Nuremberg rally and makes a band with his buddy.
Right.
You know.
But you guys are like, this is fucking bullshit. I'm fucking
know.
Stuck in Pedro.
Right.
Crap. You know, whatever this is. Which I think is great.
We're disenfranchised.
What's that?
Disenfranchised.
Yeah, disenfranchised. But, you know, for me, part of the bummer of what happened to punk rock was that, you know, it was so self-righteous in a lot of ways.
And lastly, anarchy. It got very formula.
Yeah, that's what I mean. So
yeah.
It became like, if you didn't act a certain way and dress a certain way and play a certain way, you weren't punk rock. It's like, fuck, who gives a shit?
Yeah, because it really set up against that kind of stuff, I thought. That's why I was attracted to it.
Well, that was the idea, yeah.
Yeah. And
that's where the Minutemen's, like, that's really its own thing. There's no other band in the world that's like the Minutemen. You know? I know we're talking about your past from 30 years ago, but still, you know.
Well, you know what? This is trippy. I get asked by young people all the time, what was the real punk like? So they're suspicious, too.
Yeah.
You know? Because the promise of the slogan is so huge, and then the reality can be kind of a letdown.
That's true, I know.
Yeah.
And then the whole punk rock thing, you know, I always thought that in some ways to me, the only thing worse than an aging hippie is an aging punk rocker.
Well, that's me.
You're not, no, you're not that. You're an alien. You're a rock and roll mutant. So, I mean, the people that have these notions of what things are supposed to be, you know, just you and I talking about music, it's like, well, you know, hardcore, you know, aging punk rocker would talk about John Coltrane with reverence or whatever.
No.
Maybe I'm not making sense, but...
No, you are, but my basic thing is I'm here to learn, so I don't have it figured out, even though circumstance gave me some years, you know, I pulled some shifts, but I'm still here to learn. And actually, I heard Coltrane through punk people.
See, there you go.
So,
I'm wrong, yeah.
You know, I do owe, you know, Pettibone. That's where I meet Pettibone. There was some very interesting people in the old days. There still are some. Like I said, the promise is so big, it does attract people who are looking for something.
Yeah.
And so maybe they, in their own hearts, can keep it alive by daring to take chances. But anybody wants to, you know, set up a museum or something, yeah, it's kind of bizarre.
I got you. I see what you mean.
But to me, it's, you know, the knowing is in the doing, and that's the only place it can exist. And not really, I you know, I'm human, I get sentimental, but in a way, you got to let go if you really are into it. I mean, the word punk was, you know, it's a guy who gets fucked in jail for cigarettes. I mean, why would anybody call their music this?
Hell,
I remember the first time I heard it.
If you called someone a punk, it was my mom told me.
Yeah.
It was funny with a punk.
Yeah.
It had nothing to do with music.
Yeah, no. And it was like, wow, why did they call it this? But then what I saw was like, you know what? They just don't care what anybody thinks. And it still hadn't codified into some kind of orthodoxy. And it was almost like anything goes.
Which is fucking beautiful, yeah, I know.
Right. So whatever name you call it. And then we saw certain things to, you know, because Pettibone and Art, he knew about Dada. He taught me about Dada. And actually, the stuff was going on in the teens, you know. Of the last century, and then people like Woody Guthrie in a way. So it really had a lot of strains. It didn't really start in 1976.
That's a good way to look at it, I think. Yeah,
yeah, to me, that's the only place it has value. And the idea of starting your own band that can't have started in 76, but for some reason it had urgency for us.
No, that was your thing. That was your reality, yeah.
Right.
And Buddy Holly or somebody like that. It's like, you know, people talk about Elvis, but, you know, fucking Buddy Holly wrote his own song and stuff.
Yeah, he was wild.
He was crazy.
Yeah, D-Boom was a big fan.
Something. He's dead at 22.
Yeah.
It's like rock star, you know, mythological death or whatever, but I don't know. I get kind of frustrated with, I wish my mind could be blown by some new sounds coming out, but I think I'm just overtired from raising. I got two kids now, you know. If someone would have told me 6 years ago I'd have two kids and a house and all that stuff, I'd been like, I'm not dead, really? Okay, I'm surprised.
Yeah, but like for this film here,
yeah,
that you made music to,
mm-hmm.
You probably got the inspiration for the music from watching the film.
No, not at all.
Oh, no? Okay.
They sent me a script of it. We talked about some things. And then I just started creating these pieces of music that I guess I just wanted to create them anyway, you know, for whatever they'd be, Flaming Lips or something else. And so I'd send them a track, and they, we love it. And they'd put it into a piece of the film, and I'd send them another track that had a totally different sort of trip to it, you know. And they put that in the film, and it's kind of going like that, really, where I'm just sending them pieces of music, and they're placing them into the film. So I think it's gonna be pretty good, actually. That's how it works out. I feel like there's a couple of, because what they want from me is different moods and stuff, you know, for their different scenes. And
so you're providing the inspiration.
Yeah.
So that's intense.
They're really loud. Sorry. I'm sitting in the back porch here.
No, that's cool. But that's intense, because you're providing the inspiration. And then you talk about, whoa, man, I wish I could hear some new sounds. I want some inspiration. And that's a human thing, I think, is taking turns with the dilemmas.
Yeah, that's cool. I know what you mean. But this film, it could be pretty good. We'll see what happens. But
does it have a title yet?
I think it's called The Heart is a Drum Machine. I think that's what they're calling it right now. And what they're trying to cover is how music, you know, to me, more than any other art form, and I think they're saying the same thing, is really connected to the human psyche and, you know, our emotions and evolution and everything. I mean, music is so much a part of that, you know, rhythm and everything, you know.
Right.
You know, my son Daniel, he's like 2.5, right?
Yep.
And he's not, I don't think he's super advanced in any way. I mean, he likes letters and numbers, and he loves animals, and he likes stacking blocks, so he's a thinking kid. But man, he can, you know, he can sing the ABC song like kind of in pitch and in rhythm. It's really bizarre.
Wow.
Like he can sing A B C D E, and it's weird, you know. I mean, maybe I'm just a proud father, but I think that's pretty intense that he's doing that already, just 2.5, you know.
You think he's gonna grow up be a musician?
When Becky and I, Becky, my wife, talked about him being born, I'm like, whatever he wants to do, I'm fine with. But I'll be really over the moon if he takes to music. I mean, he's already taking to music, and you know? He seems to be really into it. But maybe we'll see what happens. But hopefully he's already embracing music. You know, he loves some things. He loves craft work, which is cool.
When he gets 6, are you going to put him in the band?
Wayne talks about that. I feel like your old man did. Yeah, playing like keyboards or something. Like, yeah, slow down.
And that's an old tradition. That's like vaudeville, where you put the family in the act.
Yeah. Well, you know, what's funny is that, you know, my dad's pretty sick right now. He's in a nursing home down in Texas. But I went and saw him about, I guess, 2 weeks ago. Probably since the last time I talked to you on the phone.
And, yeah, in fact, you called me, LaGrange.
Oh, that's right. And fucking Minutemen was playing on fucking XM radio.
In the rental car.
Yeah. How cool is that? And that's where we were talking. Like, it's fucking D-Boone's birthday, man.
Yeah.
That was a weird thing. But yeah, I went down and saw my dad, and he told me that he just, I don't know why, he just had just recently found out that his grandfather started a polka waltz band in Texas in 1890, and it was like the leader of this band.
Damn.
So it goes way back. And
yeah.
So I'm sure Daniel, my little boy, will be involved with music somehow, you know. But for me, it's like, if he wants to do it, I'm into it. If he doesn't care about it, I don't care either, you know. I mean, but he's so surrounded and involved with it every day. I mean, every day I'm in my little studio, and he comes in there, and now his new thing is he'll come to me and he'll go, rock, rock. And what that means is he wants to come into my little studio office and play music with me, which is cool.
Oh, wow.
Rock, rock.
Now, are you working on new lips songs?
I got a few. Wayne and I always have a pile of stuff before we go into the studio for a new record or something, you know. I think
right.
I got three or four things, and it just depends on. We probably won't start recording the next record till early spring of next year or something, you know. But Wayne's always got a ton of ideas, and he's always thinking so far in the future, and then I've always got songs that I just want to record, just these ideas I want to record, but I want to record them with Wayne singing and the sounds that we do in the Flaming Lips world, you know what I mean?
Yep.
But yeah, we'll have plenty of stuff ready to go when it's time to go. So.
But the next project is the movie.
Yeah, that's what I'm still working on that right now.
Yeah.
Actually, this week I'm working on because besides the songs I'm doing for the movie, they want me to do these covers, like, they want to make a separate CD that's going to come out with the movie, just like cover versions of songs.
Yeah.
So, this sounds weird, but I'm going to do a cover version of the Border song by Elton John with Maynard from Tool. We're going to do that.
Wow.
And then right now I'm working on the I don't know if you know the I don't know if you like Radiohead. They have a song called the Pyramid Song.
I saw them at Coachella. And
how was that?
They reminded me of Pink Floyd.
Well, yeah, totally, man.
You know, that's what I was thinking of. I mean, there's some beats and stuff that seem more contemporary, but it reminded me of the vibe. And it was mainly around the singer, it seemed like.
Yeah, I could see that. Well, I didn't like Radiohead for a long, long time. I didn't start liking them until a few years ago, really, but now I'm kind of going back and listening to these records that I kind of naysay when they came out, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Now I'm like, man, I was wrong about that stuff. Some of this stuff is really, whatever, it's just good music, you know? So I'm doing, they have this song called the Pyramid Song, which I think is one of the, if you want to Google it or something, check it out. I think
okay.
It's one of the finest things ever recorded. So I'm doing a cover of that, and I'm trying to figure out who I can get to sing it. But it's pretty psychedelic.
So you're collaborating with people.
What's that?
You're collaborating with people.
Yeah, yeah. So I'm getting different people together for some different cover versions.
And that's new for you.
What's that?
That's new for you.
Yeah, yeah. For me, personally, the Flaming Lips, we always do things with different people, but it's kind of a nice project because I'm really just doing all this stuff myself. Just me, just doing it by myself, like kind of working in a void by myself and to see if I can get, see this through and get this shit done, because it's always been my problem. I'll start a project and then, 6 months later I get bored with it, so I just, it kind of, just...
Back burner.
Yeah, it just kind of dies on the table there or whatever. But this one, I'm going to see this one through and give it my best shot. But it's fun, so...
Well, yeah, like you're putting together bands for the songs, a band, a song.
That's what I'm trying to do. Yeah,
yeah.
I've only got two ideas so far, but I've got some time, so I'm thinking like stupid stuff. Like I want to get I don't know if you know who Goldfrapp is, Allison Goldfrapp, singer.
No,
she's wonderful. I'm going to try to get her to do a hard cover with me.
Heart,
yeah. You probably don't like Heart, but man,
I remember them.
Man, if you were 7 years old and you heard Barracuda, dude,
they were kind of like a Led Zeppelin band with a woman singer.
I know that's what you think, but and they were. But if you listen to that stuff now, it's like it's just some of that stuff's really fucking wicked, Magic Man. But see, you were too old for that. You're like, God, that shit's fucking square, classic. But, I'll say it again. If you were 7 years old and you heard Barracuda, you're like, man, that's fucking badass.
Well, the lady had some pipes. She could sing.
Yeah, yeah. And they had cool guitar textures and stuff, and synthesizers and stuff like that, Effects pedals.
Oh,
you guys didn't know about in the 70s.
No, not at all. And on this new record, I didn't use any. Nels brought in 30.
Thinking about the effects pedals thing with you, I love that idea of like, man, we didn't know there was like a fuzz pedal, or a flanger, or a phase pedal, or whatever.
No, Nels brought in 36 pedals.
I bet he did. Yeah, that guy, he's a maniac, man.
And Jimmy, the engineer, they're talking pedal talk, and I'm watching. don't know what to say. He has no knowledge.
I did want to ask you something about, because I know you, I mean, you absolutely love John Coltrane and all
yeah.
these guys, right? And these guys, you know, besides being original artists, right? I mean, they absolutely were innovative and inventive and all those kinds of things, you know?
Yeah.
And what they did was they had a hardcore knowledge of how music works, of music theory, right?
Right, right.
They had to have their craft. And then you guys are coming from a viewpoint of, like, not knowing anything about music, right?
Right.
But creating a new art form.
Trying.
Right. And it seemed to me, and this is just my perspective, it seemed like that punk rock, for lack of a better term, was anti-music theory or anti-knowing how to... knowing about music, right?
Yeah, because it was a kind of anti-rock establishment. So you don't want to, yeah, you don't want to know how to play because that's what they're doing.
Right, but as you grew older and the years went by and stuff, and you got into John Coltrane or whoever, did it seem like
Well, what Coltrane did, because we actually thought he was doing punk. I didn't know he was dead. I thought he was an older guy doing it, but I thought he was an old guy doing punk. Because right. what we felt in Coltrane music was the emotion, and that's what we thought was lost in the fusion and the more progressive technical thing.
You just nailed it right there.
It was this like human feeling. Even though the man had technique up the yang, we didn't know because we didn't know how to appreciate that. We just had this feeling coming out of the speakers like, God damn.
Okay.
And, you know, and not having any knowledge of that music, it sounded kind of noisy. But this feeling came out, and it struck a chord in us. We thought it was part of this other movement, you know. We didn't know. And then finding out about him and stuff, and his history, and especially in his later years where he's taking stuff out, he took a lot of blows from his own, you know, field, his own...
Yeah, yeah.
Right? They were calling it anti-jazz, right? Downbeat magazine, writing articles, anti-jazz.
Right, because he was going so far left field, yeah.
Yeah, isn't that weird? I mean, we find this out later. Didn't know. Didn't
but
know
he
anything.
Play anything, that's the thing, you know.
That's right. But,
yeah, he wasn't playing blindly. He was playing like he knew what he was playing.
No, that dude practiced 10 or 12 hours a day.
So I wondered about that with you, like your perception of that, like, you know, not knowing about how music theory worked, you know, all that kind of stuff.
Yeah, we didn't know at all, you know, and it was just the emotion. And that stuff, that's what we were feeding on. We didn't really know sax players. We didn't grow up with any.
Why would you, yeah?
Yeah, we didn't, even keyboard players, you know? We didn't know anybody. In the old days, keyboards cost a lot of money.
No doubt, yeah.
And no one in the projects where we were had those things. We didn't know. So a lot of this stuff, they're just sounds off records. We don't know about how it's made. Shit, we didn't even know how the guitar shit was really made.
Yeah, that's what you mean.
You know, we're stumbling around.
I used to wonder about that, like the legitimacy of music, if you knew too much about music. But it's like, it's almost like a vocabulary, you know. If you want to say something, you have to know certain words.
All right. I know what you mean, like sort of with a painting, when the Gauguin and the primitive clay stuff.
Yeah.
They're trying to get to this other essence and get away from the... trying to be like a photograph, you know, Vermeer or something.
Yeah, exactly. So, you know,
we got cameras to do that, so why paint like that? Why not try to get back to the spirit? And that's the way we looked at it too. Yeah, in fact, we were embarrassed. I mean, as retarded and lame as we were, we still knew, you know, Bucks Boogie, Oyster Cult, and these cats couldn't play that. You know, and we felt tainted. And that's why these bands like Wire and the Pop Group were really intense on us. They just said there's no rules. You could go... And we went for these little song formats and everything to try to hide the rock and roll. We were kind of embarrassed about it, in a way. These guys, they were doing it because they're just learning.
It's crazy,
you know?
Isn't it?
I know. When I look back on it, we were ridiculous and stuff. But
no, that's just the way it was. You know?
Yeah.
I think that's totally legitimate. And it, I think what happened with, you know, the American, whatever, for lack of a better term, like the American indie rock scene, it couldn't have happened if people all knew how to play their instruments and stuff, you know. But at the same time, that whole scene, when I finally discovered it 10 years too late, it was like, wow, you really can do things any way you want to, you know.
Yeah, I know.
You don't have to sound like Led Zeppelin or whoever, or
right.
Floyd or John Coltrane or fucking, you know, Bach or whatever. You can create your own thing. And that was, for me, that was a real eye-opener, you know.
Yeah. Well, I think early on we were really hit over the head with this idea of talent. You could only really appreciate people with talent. We didn't have enough faith in ourselves to say, well, we'll decide who has the talent. And maybe it doesn't go with the herd right now. And because we see something in it, it's touching us somehow. There's some vibe, emotion. Early Daniel Johnston songs.
Yeah.
Technically, they're not that together, but they have a spirit.
Well, you can't top that, yeah.
Yeah, you know what I mean? Yeah, it's a trip.
You can't top that. That's a whole different means of expression, you know.
Right, and so...
That's what I wondered about for many years. I couldn't reconcile, like, knowing music theory, you know, what I did learn when I was growing up and stuff, just on my own, and then, like, being, you know, quote-unquote punk rock. It seemed like those two just couldn't coexist together, but... That's not right at all.
No. And you got to understand our circumstances. In some ways, we were scapegoating, too. We were really angry at the culture that we were in of not using music as expression, not writing your own songs. And we blamed it all on the arena rock stuff. Why didn't anybody we know wrote their own songs? Why weren't we writing our own songs? Why were we copying off records in the bedroom? Why weren't we trying to use music as a way of getting feelings out? And so it became almost, yeah, a war. And when you get like that, you don't think about things, and you're looking for people in uniforms. And
that makes sense.
You know, and so that's kind of where we were at. And but interesting, early on, D. Boone told me, you know, whatever we play, it'll still be the Minutemen. I thought, well, okay, yeah, I'm into that. And, you know, the Flaming Lips epitomize that. You cats can do any music, and you're going to be the Lips.
Well, we got in a good spot, you know. I think we decided, you know, sometime in the late 90s, like, you know, why try to be one specific thing you have to do, you know? Why
right.
Pull all these other excuse me, elements of whatever musics and bring them together and make them Flaming Lips music, you know?
Music's too big, and that other thing's kind of a marketing angle or something, you know, to get you stuck into one sound.
Yeah, no, it's true. That's true today as well as any other time, really.
Right. And so the idea, you coming together as music people, everything's fair game. You know, you're going to use different motifs or you know, whatever. Phrasings, melody, chords.
Yeah, it's all just expression. Yeah.
Right, and then the different instruments. You can put the drums on. You can put the guitar on. Whatever the tune, you're going to serve the tune instead of the other way around.
Yeah,
you know.
There you go, yeah.
And it's one of the reasons why after Firehose, I decided not to have one band anymore. And I would just play with different people, and those projects would be their own little lives, where you guys did it under the sort of like the, like I was saying, the early idea of what D. Boone said, the Minutemen. Whatever we're doing, that'll be the Minutemen.
Oh, definitely, yeah. That's definitely our theory about it. You know, just whatever we're doing, it's under the Flaming Lips umbrella.
Yeah, and I think like, you guys, by daring like that, really are a lightning rod for inspiration that way. Not to copy the Flaming Lips, because that would be a disrespectful, but this idea where you're going to know it's us because these individuals come together and make an interesting conversation, but we're going to talk about different things. It's not going to be the same cliche every time. We are four individuals, three individuals that come together that are got their own personas and then come together with their common ground. You're going to know it's the Flaming Lips. It's not going to be just a the changing of clothes. It's just a different way to relate. You know, that bond you guys have built, that togetherness,
yeah,
that sharing.
I know what you mean. So, like, for you, is there, could you tell me, like, in words, like, is there something you're still wanting, really desiring to do that you haven't done yet?
Yeah, I mean, you know, there is a fucking intense thing about the art of writing a song. I want to write good songs.
Man, you're never going to get over that. You're like, God damn it, man. There's this one thing I want to do that I can't. You don't even know what it is you want to do. You just want to do this thing, you know. You know what I mean? Like, you get like a feeling, right? Does that make sense? Like some kind of emotional thing you get, and you're trying to turn it into, you know, musical melodies and chords. And
right.
For me, words are like, I can never write words, and I can
they're
try
tough
to express myself musically and melodically, but never with words. It never adds up, you know. But that's where Wayne comes in. That's where he helps my songs so much, you know. But, you know, you get that feeling like, man, I want to do this thing, but you can't fucking get a grasp on it, you know.
And it's not like more and more notes. You know, you're looking for the right notes.
Yeah.
Sort of like good bass lines. It's not more and more notes. It's the right notes.
It's the right notes, yeah. Or
you
just
know,
one note.
Right.
One
it can note. Be so econo. It could be one note, you know, and you're just finding it. So that's, yeah. When do you ever reach that?
That's funny. You know? One of my things I try to do all the time is, I don't know if you've noticed this in some of our music, but what I like to do is, like, where the same note plays, like a melodic note will play, but then the chords around it keep changing around the same melodic note, though.
Right, right.
And that's always fun to do. Like,
yeah,
you play a C on the bass, and I would try to play every chord that I could match with the C.
Yeah, counterpoint.
Yeah.
In harmony.
That's fun to do, too. Like, you know, 20 different ways to say the same thing, you know.
Right, right. It's kind of how gravity works. Pulls things. Well, gravity, everything pulls on each other and influences each other and relates to each other. And I think sound and music is that way too. Even dissonance, because that creates a tension. Because music can also be like a film or a book where you have drama. So you make a tension and then you release it and you let it resolve.
One man's dissonance is another man's, you know.
Right, but it can cause a moment of drama, and then you resolve it. I hear this a lot in Lips music. You guys bring up tension, and then you resolve it, and everything seems to all float, but you don't leave it there. You make a landscape, so it has hills and valleys.
That's fun, yeah. It's fun trying to do that kind of stuff, man.
Right, and so that's pretty much a mission, and so I'm trying to put my bass in different situations where I can try and learn, you know, because the other thing is you do want to be distinctive.
Absolutely, yeah.
I mean, you got children. My Akachans are the songs. They're going to be the things here after me.
Hey, so, me too. Same with me. Yeah.
Well, then you have... and children and song children. So, but for me, this is my legacy and stuff. So it's intense. I mean, people can watch me play a gig and look funny, old man, you know, work this thing. But when I'm not here to perform for him, I have to have things that carry on. So it's one of the reasons I'm so intent now on recording a lot. The last 10 years, I've been a little out of balance. I've been doing a lot more gigs than recording. And you know, in the old days, the Minutemen days, we did recordings every 9 months because it was like flyers. We never really thought of it was like, you know, this shit will be here when you're gone. And we were so in the moment.
Well, totally, yeah.
We thought the gig was everything. So the recordings, they were just flyers to get people to the gig. But we are human, and you can only do so many gigs. You know, before your time gets cut.
And you're getting old, man.
Yeah. Or you go young like D. Boone, and thank God he made recordings. Or we only the dudes who were at those gigs would have knowledge. So I think making works is an important part of it, too.
You're definitely doing that now, so...
Yeah, I'm really intent on it. I got a lot of plans, and I'm trying to do this. And in fact, I've been doing things where I just have kids send me their music, and I put bass to it. I don't know the bands, I don't know the people, make music on the power book, or I do kind of know the people or whatever. I just am trying to do this, which is so much different from my tradition, because I come out of like, I want to be with this guy, I want to hang out with this guy. This is one way we're going to do it, is with music. I never saw myself as like, maybe I could put a bass to music and not even know these people. That's kind of a newer thing for me.
It's pretty inspiring, really.
And not be like sideman, food chain kind of shit, trying to service a lifestyle, but actually be musical about it. Like, I'm going to give you my best notes. I'm going to try hard. Just because for the sake of music.
That's cool, man. I don't
have to
say that.
So. No, well, you asked me what am I trying to do so these days, and that's pretty hell-bent mission for me.
Nice.
Well, having folks like you, you know, out there putting your ideas out really inspires me, man. And I can't thank you enough about that, man.
Well, I would say we're lucky. You know, I'm lucky that, you know, I mean, how great is it that it worked out that all I have to do is like play music and I get to live my life and do what I want. You know what I mean?
Right. But don't you feel a burden of having to be creative? That's kind of tough.
Sometimes I do, but then sometimes I'm just, man, I'm so happy that that's the reality that I...
Yeah, right.
What I have to do is come up with, you know, art.
Have you ever had blocks?
All the time, yeah. All the time.
I mean, aren't they frustrating?
No, I mean, Wayne and I talk about this all the time. Sometimes when you think you're blocked is when you're coming up with your best stuff, because it shuts off some part of your brain that's trying to change the world, and you're just like, you're just doing something nonchalantly, and it ends up, you know, you hear it 10 years later, it's like, man, that's one of the best things I ever did, you know. So it kind of goes back and forth. I'm not sure if that makes any sense.
Well, I'm saying it's a struggle as any kind of other job in a way.
Yeah.
You know, it just doesn't automatically come all the time.
Absolutely.
There's a little work involved.
No, I mean, even like this, you know, this music documentary or whatever, you know, that I'm working on, it's like, you know, I'll get an inspiration for an idea, and it just stops there. As soon as I start doing the work, it's like, oh, this is bullshit. This is like hack work, you know. This is nothing new. But then I start to get into it, and then I hear it like 3 weeks later, it's like, oh, that's, no, I like that, you know. But that's just the way it goes for me. I'm not sure how it goes for you.
But. No, but the struggle to realize, you got an idea, but then to realize the idea.
Yeah, exactly. No, you just said it right.
That is a tough thing, yeah. And some way I'd like to get a better relationship with the machine, with the bass, to realize things a little easier. I don't know if that ever comes. It seems like you learn certain kinds of things to do, and they lead to other things. So you're lame at them, and then you're trying to get onto them.
Yeah.
Like there's this documentary, The World According to John Coltrane, and they're talking to... Rashid Ali, one of his last drummers, and he's saying, the guy's practicing all the time. He was already so good. Why did he do that? But what I'm thinking is, well, this is probably what happened. He'd conquer some discipline, but that would lead to more possibilities. He'd have to chase them down. It never was going to end. I mean, if you're truly bitten with a bug.
Yeah, that's the struggle, you know. It's a healthy thing.
Right? Like, oh, I'm good enough now.
No, I mean, it's a healthy thing to always be, like, thinking that you can learn more.
Yeah, right, right. I believe that.
I definitely go through phases where it seems like every year around October or something, I start becoming obsessed with playing piano again, trying to learn, listening to fucking... you know who Bill Evans is?
Sure.
Yeah. Dude, I'm a Bill Evans fanatic at this point.
So is Miles.
Listening to Bill Evans and Thelonious Monk and all those motherfuckers. And like,
Monk, yeah.
It just gets so... gets dense trying to figure out what they're doing. You know, I have about 5 books on... not piano jazz theory, but just the theory of Bill Evans' chordal structures and stuff like that. And, you know, I'll never figure it out. But every year I get involved into it and I learn, you know, a million times more than I knew before. And it's great. You know? So that'll be an ongoing thing with me for the rest of my life. And that was his trip, too. Bill Evans was always like, man, I'm not very good, you know. Miles Davis called him the best keyboard player they'd ever played with.
He's called him his favorite white man.
Yeah. What was the lines like? I don't care if it's green, black, yellow, or white, motherfucker. What,
you know? Yeah, that autobiography is something else. But, you know, having a sense of humility like that, I think, keeps you in the learning phase. If you get it too figured out, you get cynical, I think.
That's one way of looking at it. The other way of looking at it is it's not humility, it's just curiosity. You're always just curious.
Well, humble, like you don't have it figured out.
Right, right.
That's what I mean. Like, I have to acknowledge that, you know. And some cats, especially if you're in the game long enough, you know, I've done that, I've seen that, I've heard that, I don't need to know anymore.
Yeah.
And I think that isn't as healthy, maybe.
Well, it's not. Not at all. And that's where we talk about Coltrane again, where he was always, I'm sure in the back of his mind somewhere, he was like, well, I know a lot about stuff, but I'm still learning. I'm still curious. It's like when you meet the aging, you know, classic rocker guy that, you know, will see a new band, instead of being like, ah, I've seen it all a million times, he's like, oh, this is cool. What's this?
That's a great thing. Coltrane, I got a bunch of interviews by him, and in one place he says, I think all musicians are after some kind of truth.
Yeah.
Yeah. That,
what is that, though? I have no idea.
I don't know. He didn't go further than that, but he says some kind of truth. But that's such a high mark to set. But then also being kind of gentle about it. You know, he's doing this one interview, and some guy said, asked him, I think it was his last tour in Japan, and he asked him, what would you call classical music? And he says, well, I don't know for sure, but I think that's where the people sit down to listen.
That's what he said about it.
Yeah, notice he doesn't get into the notes and the chords and all this, you know. It's the way people experienced it. That's what he's calling classical. I thought it was a really interesting thing. But that take on music, you know, to be kind of humble of it, in awe of it, like you say, curious.
Well, that's totally Coltrane, though, you know, more than Miles Davis. Miles Davis seemed like, maybe I'm speaking out of line, but he just seemed like, ah, and all this shit.
Yeah, yeah. I kind of got that reading his book.
Like, yeah,
that no playing motherfucker, Steve Miller. Whenever he gets into that, like, because he always liked to go on before people. He never liked playing after.
Yeah, there you go.
Yeah, right. All right, Miles. That book is intense.
I want to go back to the John Coltrane thing with you because
yeah.
You really worship John Coltrane.
Yeah, I do.
I mean, not just his music, but his lifestyle and everything. So.
Yeah. Well, look at his war with the drogas.
What's that?
His war with the drogas. You know, 10 years it had him. And what Richard Meltzer told me was really important to the scene was when he quit and got better. Because everybody was looking up to Bird and Parker, and you have to be fucked up to really play good. And Meltzer told me that was really intense to the scene, for not just for himself to get healthy. And he only lived 10 more years. But to the scene, like, you don't have to be as fucked up as Bird. And be musical still.
It's a weird thing, isn't it?
Yeah.
To think that you... to try to imagine his mindset back in those days, you know?
Oh, yeah. But the other thing, too, you know, his last tour was going to be... no band. He was going to just play with spiritual people around the world and have them teach him. John wow. Coltrane. Yeah. It's a trip.
Totally, yeah.
You know. And then his music, when I listen to it, it is so much...
Hold on one.
Okay.
Hold on. Yo, these run at this time. So. Over there, yeah. Still there?
Yeah.
Yeah.
He starts playing with Pharoah Sanders and more primitive kind of bluesy things, and he doesn't evolve it into, you know, more and more tight arrangements and more Bach-like stuff. You know, he's trying to almost get more at the spirit of it as he goes on.
Just raw kind of...
Yeah, rawness, which is a trip, huh? Not refining it. Almost in opposition of trying to refine it.
But see, that's where it's great, because he had the skill to play very precise, specific things.
Right.
So what he was doing was honing in on just his raw emotions and how to express them.
Right, and maybe that was his truth, the truth he was looking for.
The way to do it, you know, if you did that every night, where you weren't playing the same gig every night, and you weren't playing the same things over and over again, or you could be, but just trying to, like with the great jazz guys, they would play these standards, or not at that point with him, but he was playing songs and just to every night try to reach in deeper, you know.
Right, reinvent it.
It had to be pretty a powerful feeling and feel pretty good to do that, you know.
Yeah.
Does that make sense? I don't know if it makes sense.
Well, this is one of the reasons I look up to him.
Yeah.
He dared, you know, to push. Not just say the wall's over there, but push against to make sure it's there. And if it is there, try to push it further.
Yeah, cool.
And for me, man, that is a big goal. I have another interview with him. The guy asked him, you know, when you're soloing like that, what are you listening to? And he goes, the bass. And I love that.
Yeah, I missed out, man. I've been born 3 years before. Damn. I've been born in Pedro. Let's see, what else?
He said some another bizarre thing in that same spiel. It was like a year after he quit the druggas in 1958, and he says, "Yeah, we're playing in a minor key, and no one hits the third."
What does that mean?
Well, you flat the third in a minor. So, means it's all intent. You know, it's never actualized.
That's cool.
Yeah, it's really taking it up a level. But, you know, he's in the realm of ideas, but then making them real by working that reed. So that, to me, that's a great marriage. It's just so intense.
I mean, thinking about this third thing.
Yeah, you're playing a minor key and no one ever hits the third. So how do you know it's minor?
That is nice. I like that. You kind of blow my mind with that, because, you know, like, you know, even in some like rock and roll and stuff, it's like you get the power, you know, the power fits or whatever. There's
right.
There's no third, but it's implied. You know, it's like it's either major or minor. But to, especially a bunch of crazy fucking, you know, jazz cats riffing around but never playing a minor or major third, that would be kind of interesting.
Yeah.
Man, that's cool. I like that.
Yeah, but he said, you know, what I think he's hitting on is the thing of invention, of being curious and trying to get beyond rules and regulation.
Well, music theory, yeah.
Yeah, in his case, music theory.
Well, with him, it's like knowing the rules and then, like, here's the rules as they apply to what I'm doing, and then I'm just going to step outside those rules. You know?
Otherwise...
Other than chaos, which is not knowing the rules at all. You know?
Right, right. Which is, you know, somebody's just starting out, you can expect that, you know. Other people, maybe, you know, shtick.
Yeah.
Yeah, right. It's just a trippy thing like that about making music special. I know music talks to people in a lot of ways. Some people use it, you know, for peer pressure. Every military unit has a drummer boy.
That's true, yeah.
You know, so it's used for all kinds of weird stuff. But to me, he put it in an ideal that I looked up to. And I don't know. He speaks to me, his music. Also, maybe not being raised with that music, I have never systematized it. It's always new and fresh to me.
That makes sense, yeah. That makes sense, because, you know, when I was growing up, you know, my dad was a horn player and stuff, but I didn't hear any jazz growing up. I would hear it here and there, but it never meant anything to me. It was always like, doo, 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 doo. You know what I mean? The stereotypical jazz thing. I didn't care about it at all.
Predictable.
Yeah.
Right, and you end up in I Love Lucy rerun world.
Yeah.
You know, okay, this week it's mayonnaise, next week it'll be pizzas. And
yeah, exactly, yeah.
Right.
And then, like, starting to really listen to it for the first time when I was about 25 or 26, listening. I think Miles Davis probably hit me before anybody else did, but Sketches of Spain, that was something that really, like, this is just really fucking psychedelic music.
Yeah, you know what I think one of Miles' great talents was, too, was putting together the right band. He knew how to get cats together.
Well, he saw a talented guy and said, I want that guy. And
yeah.
Like, okay, you're Miles Davis, I'll play with you. So Bill Evans, you know, he and Miles Davis were really tight for a few years, you know. And Miles Davis always said he thought he was the best piano player that he ever played with. So.
Sketches, you know, he wanted to do Sketches of Spain with Jimi Hendrix.
I know.
And Jimi was embarrassed that he didn't know how to read and stuff.
And then he died.
So. And then he died. But he was kind of embarrassed. Jimi Hendrix. I heard he was kind of embarrassed of his voice, too.
Yeah.
Great singer.
Supposedly he struggled with that. I know.
Amazing cat.
You know, but we're
humans, inside insecurities. It's hard to get that from
I'm not sure about
it. He didn't know how to put together bands. I think he did have humility. He looked at Gillespie and said, I'm never going to have them chops. So I'm going to have the best cats playing with me.
There you go. But he also wrote some fucking great songs.
Yeah. Totally. And when Miles changed, the scene changed. He was a trailblazer, man. You know, out of all those notes of bebop, he gets back to the blues modes, you know.
Just punk rock, yeah.
Yep, and then he goes for he kind of invents fusion. You know, he goes with young people, young rock people.
White dudes.
Yeah. There's a song called John McLaughlin.
I know. Yeah. I don't know how you feel about Mahavishnu Orchestra.
I saw him. I liked him.
When did you see them?
Oh, 75, 76, Birds of Fire.
Are you serious?
Yeah.
I didn't know that.
I saw it at the Long Beach Arena with Rick Laird on bass, Jerry Goodman on violin, Billy Cobham, Jan Hammer on the synthesizer, John McLaughlin on fuzz tone 12 string.
That guy, man, for about 5 years was just, oh, man. I mean, jazz, punk rock, whatever you want to call it, just fucked up skronk stuff.
Yeah. Big Nels Klein, big fan.
I bet he seems like he'd be a John McLaughlin fan.
Yeah.
That makes me very happy to hear that, actually.
Yeah, big time. That band was intense. It was visceral, man. It was, whew.
Yeah.
And then, you know, after them, you know, Return to Forever, you know.
Right.
You know, that didn't hit me the same.
Well, it's Chick Corea, right? I mean, isn't that Chick Corea?
Al Di Meola, yeah, and Stanley Clark.
Yeah, it gets kind of, that's when it becomes like fusion in a bad way.
Yeah, see what I mean? So the genre thing, it's easy to make fun of the fusion and stuff, but Mahavishnu, man, that stuff was intense.
Yeah, what's the first record called? The Intermountain Flame?
Yeah.
Yeah. Or is it Birds of Fire? I can't remember. No, it's Intermounting Flame, yeah. That's, yeah. It's weird because it's got some bad prog elements about it, but there's some moments where it's just sheer, like, beautiful noise kind of stuff, you know. Like, man, what a weird combination of sounds. But
they were a great band. Only a couple records, and there's a live record. I think only, like, three records, really.
Yeah.
So they were only a brief thing.
I'm not sure what he's doing. Floating around a spaceship somewhere. Double neck spaceship.
But you know, the Bitches Brew, you know what he comes out of that? That bass player, Michael Henderson, he ends up a disco singer.
Really?
Very strange, yeah.
That is.
But you know, music is a trippy thing. You know, Rimbaud only wrote poems for 2 years of his life. You know, he was running guns after that.
I didn't know that.
Yeah, some people, it's not like Elvin Jones, you know, where it's that's it.
Yeah.
Sometimes it's just a little brief periods. And with bands, they're like that too, which is another great thing about the Flame and Lips, still vital. Not just a brief blip and then retread and milk in some, you know, past blip glory. You guys are still in the thing, man.
Not like the Sex Pistols or something.
Yeah, or but there's countless bands that are doing that stuff.
Right, like, I got you.
You know, and you guys, you refuse to be sentimental that way, and you want to dare and get beyond her.
No, we're lucky, though. We can, you know, I think Wayne and I always talk about the fact that we can always drag our past along with us, you know, and always have the past, you know, 10, 15, 20 years with us, but then always trying to create something new.
Yeah, you don't have to lean on it, though.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Because you're still vital in the moment.
It's a lucky place to be, for sure.
Yeah. Yeah. But I think you guys kind of work at it, too. But, and also, I got to say this, too. I think the listeners are pretty open-minded, which is a righteous thing.
Again, we're lucky, you know, lucky again that I think that, you know, people that come to us for the first time, just they latch on to one thing about us that they like, but then they quickly discover that there's all these other things happening as well. You know, someone that likes a record from 90, you know, would be like, oh, I like that era of the Flaming Lips, but then we're still going, they can still hear new things. And that,
right.
I like that too. I'm not sure if that makes any sense.
Yeah, it does to me.
So, and then we got these, you know, look out in the crowd. It's like, I'll see kids are like 16, 17. And I'll see, like, you know, people your age, Mike, 15 years old, like the old schoolers, you know, or older, you know. And it's, yeah, it's a good feeling just to, you know, to see that that wide spectrum of age differences, and people are all enjoying it. Sorry, I'm kind of.
No, but I think that's what music's really about. It's about being huge and through generations and through different kinds of folks. It's the fabric that connects us, especially when materialism, stuff like that, lets us down. It goes through its cycles. So music, it's a true human fabric.
Well, it's like I'll get, you know, sometimes on MySpace I'll get like a friend request from, you know, Sid, he's 16, he lives in Alabama somewhere, you know.
Yeah.
And his music favorites are like Flaming Lips and some punk rock stuff, and then Miles Davis, and then the Bee Gees, and then Led Zeppelin. It's like, how fucking cool is that?
I think it's great.
Some 16-year-old kid knows about all this different stuff and loves all of it. You know?
And he hasn't been like beat down with marketing and genre.
Exactly.
He's free.
And that's when I see stuff like that, it's like, that's fucking cool, you know, that's the way it should be.
Yeah.
Like all the stuff that's available to all of us, it doesn't have to be, I have to listen to, you know, for some, you know, 16-year-old kid to listen to what's hip now, Blink, when, no, they're not even hip anymore, I don't know, some new band, but to say like, you know, Led Zeppelin, Miles Davis, fucking Minutemen, Pink Floyd, all eras, whatever, yeah, it's great, you know.
Yeah, that's a good thing to end on. Thank you so much for talking with me, Steve.
We should end on that, yeah, because I realize that I'm totally delirious.
No, but you said a lot of good things.
We took our kids to the zoo this morning, and that was fucking awesome. We took Daniel and Charlotte to the zoo, and Daniel was like all the... My son, he's really into books with animals in them.
Yeah.
And we took him to the zoo about a year ago, but he wasn't really getting it so much. But today, like, all the animals that he loves in his books, he was seeing them for real. It was blowing his mind. He's like, zebra, zebra. He was, like, seeing a real zebra. He was freaking out. It was pretty fun.
Oh, I got to ask you a question. Well, the zebra, he's into the, you know, they're not just animals. There's types of animals.
Yeah.
And I want to ask you, what's your favorite guitar?
My favorite guitar, absolutely... is actually a Fender Jazzmaster.
I just got Tom Watson a J. Mascus model Fender Jazzmaster.
I've got a you met Chris Chandler, our road manager guy,
yeah.
Sound guy. He found me a Fender 12 in Portland for $1,800. I'm shocked.
Is it a puppet head?
It's a 66 Fender 12.
Yeah, like a long headstock.
Yeah,
they call it the puppet. That's what Nels played in the studio with me.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. That it's like. I usually see those for, like, on eBay, like, $5,000 or $6,000 if it's in any decent shape, like, from 66, but he found one for $1,800, so he's good.
Wow, it's got two split pickups?
Yep.
Yeah.
Beautiful.
And what's your favorite amp?
Favorite amp? You know, I don't know. I would probably... I'm not a Marshall guy. I would say probably like just the Fender Super Twins, like the badass Fender Super Twin reverb guys.
Wow. Yeah, they're good sound. And what's your favorite box pedal?
Oh, man. I've got like 200 at this point.
Do you have a favorite?
We have to go into each category. For fuzz, there's one. And for delay, there's one. For phaser, there's one. For flange. See, for fuzz, it's really hard to top the... You ever come across a Most Right Fuzz Right? That is...
So it's kind of older.
Yeah, that's from 68 or 69.
All right.
I know the Jefferson Airplane used them. That doesn't matter, but... I think MC5 had a couple of fuzz rides.
Wow.
Man, if you ever see a Most Right Fuzz Right stomp box,
get it,
man.
Okay.
It's fucking wicked fuzz, wicked distortion fuzz.
And what's your favorite keyboard?
Oh, man. You're killing me with this. Well, which keyboard type? Synthesizer or Rhodes or Whirlitzer? What are you talking about?
Somewhere you got a keyboard. You could say a piano, even.
I would just say, like, an acoustic grand piano is my favorite.
Okay. And favorite drums?
Favorite drums, I would say probably late 60s Gretsch kit with the Ludwig snare, probably.
Okay.
And then the bass, well,
yeah.
I don't actually have a decent bass. I've got a Unibox Badass, but it sucks.
No. So you got to work on that one then.
Looking at those, you know, your bass with the Gibson
EB3.
That's kind of hard to
talk. In the studio, I use my Thunderbird 2 66, non-reverse.
Thunderbirds are nice, yeah.
I can't play them live because the...
Which is nice.
You know about the non-reverse ones? A couple of years they made them twisted the other way.
Yeah, exactly, yeah.
And they're two-piece instead of three-piece.
Sweet.
And in the studio, I can play a long scale because I'm sitting down. But gigs, I got to play the little ones because less younger hands.
You got to jump around, yeah.
Yeah, but my hands get sore from the big ones standing up. So that's why I kind of went to the EB3.
I didn't know that.
Yeah, I went to littler basses because I was getting bad pains. Less younger, you know.
Damn. Well, man, it's good talking to
you. Yeah, absolutely. And good success with the movie.
Well, stay in touch.
Yeah, absolutely.
And I'll let you know about all that stuff. Hopefully, I think they'll be done with it probably in October or something like that. So we'll see what happens.
April 27, 2008, third hour of the Watt from Pedro show. First 2 hours there, we heard March 7th and April 21st, 2008, interviews over the phone with Stephen Droz of the Flamin' Lips. There was a lot of Watt there, okay, but that's the way Stephen wanted it. He wanted to be like kind of conducting interview with me. Anyway, he had some righteously good spiel, and I thank him hugely. Heroic, very inspiring. Thank you, Mr. Stephen. Love you much. And now here's part 8 of Jack Flanders and Dreams of India.
The things you are holding on to are all being washed away.
So true. What would a djinn want? I know they don't collect souls, but this djinn wants something. Somehow I have to get it to tell me.
You cannot.
Oh?
He will trick you.
Yeah, well, I guess I have to trick it out of him.
Ramchandar, what else can you tell us?
The djinn visits her in her dreams. That is what is weakening her. She is strong in will, but her body has become weakened.
Well, I don't think I'd be very good at deceiving a djinn.
Maybe you can find out what the pact was that she made and offer something to release it, to appease it.
Yeah, if it can be appeased. Damn, this is frustrating.
There are two dreadful enemies of man, Kama and Krodha.
Who?
Kama and Krodha.
Desire and anger.
You must develop complete control over them. They are your inner enemies. If you are defeated by your inner enemies, how can you conquer your external enemies?
Well, you've got me there.
Once you keep these inner enemies under control, the other enemies can be defeated quite easily. So it is taught in the Bhagavad Gita.
Kama and Krodha, desire and anger, sound like pretty tough cookies.
Haji?
Well, look, how can I get that djinn to talk to me?
You know where it lives.
Yes. I think I need your lantern again.
I have it waiting. Here.
Well, thanks.
You're going up there again? In the middle of the night?
Yes. I'll see you in the morning.
Djinns are like tricks.
A what?
Tricksters.
Ah.
But a sense of humor can assist.
That I know.
Remember, karma and krodha.
Desire and anger. No problem.
Yes, be careful.
Yes, thanks.
Remember.
God, once he starts, he never stops. What?
It is their world you enter. All is maya.
Illusion. But so is this world. Ah, it's a nice warm night to go for a stroll on the subcontinent. Good dogs. Well, that one sounds a bit sad. Oh, there it is. Odd, boxy shape. So dark. Silent. Waiting. So, here we are. Silent, just like before. I'm passing through the rooms. Gin room. It's the same as before. Drapes and carpets, pillows, and same dust. Well, I guess I'll just sit and wait. Oh, genie. Yoo-hoo. Jack is back. May as well get my laughs in while I can. It's nothing. No billowy cloud forming up in the ceiling. No wisps floating across the carpet. It's nothing. Hey, Jim. Hey. Hey, come on out and play. Carpet from Kashmir. Faded blue, but so deep. Beautiful design. Wait a minute. Is there something beneath the carpet? It's rippling. Water. Oh. Shallow. And there's a path. It leads up a hill. Trees. There's that sad dog again. And the palace. say? Huh. The rooms again. They appear the same. If I wasn't already in here, I'd believe I just came in. And here's the gin room. I'm back. Oh my God. There I am, sitting on the cushions, looking at the carpet. Now I'm standing up. I pick up the lantern. I'm walking across the carpet. Do I really walk that funny? Oh, I'm walking as though I'm waiting. But I'm just walking in circles. Wide, slow circles around the carpet. Now it looks like I'm walking up the hill. I stop. I'm probably listening to that dog. I continue. And I see the palace. I enter. Through the rooms. Into the gin room. And I see me sitting on the cushions. Now another me stands up, picks up the lantern, and starts wading. And both me's are walking around in circles on the carpet. Huh. Interesting shadows. The more me's that keep appearing, the more intricate the shadows become from all my lanterns. Unless I'm mistaken, I'm seeing my life. Layers and layers of shadows. Some sad, some sweet, some cruel, some funny. Just me and my shadows. Meanwhile, we're filling the palace up with jacks. Can I break this loop? Can I put myself into one of my selves and see what that self is seeing? Oh, yeah. Now, here I am, waiting. Okay, now let's just hop out of me and catch a me about to enter the gin room and see me. Okay, now here I am, and there I am, and the me's see all the other me's. But they're pretending that there's only one me. That I've left me, I don't know which me was the observer. The observer must have been also walking in circles on the carpet, but thought he was merely standing back observing. I think I've lost myself in myself. Oh, I have done it this time. No, Jack. Don't get angry. Look at all of those me's, engrossed in the patterns on the carpet, or profoundly interpreting the shadows on the walls, and they're all walking in circles. Doesn't say much for my life, does it? But it is funny. Okay, seriously, Aang. How do I get back to the real me? Assuming there was a real me to begin with. Now I'm beginning to wonder. Am I trapped in some metaphysical loop? Well, let's take one of these me's and just walk out of here. Oh, no. All the other me's are following me. God. I just want to be free of me. I want to be you. The one who knows. The big me. Meanwhile, all my little selves are following me in circles. Help me.
Do you surrender to me?
I surrender. It looks like I don't have a body. Did that djinn trick me again? Or did I trick myself? No. Cancel. I don't want to get back into that again. Well...
Watt from Pedro show. Started off the third hour there with Jack Flanders and Dreams of India, part 8. Three more parts to go. Jack tripping out in India. Let's see. What happened since last show? Last week it was at Brother Matt's. He told us about his righteous trip. Mexico, with the whales and kayak. And we had some guests over at the Love Grotto on the Pleasure Point. And in between, yeah. Last night I played in Pedro with Tom and Raul, the Missing Man. They did so good on their new stuff. All sparkly, but sounding good. God, they're beautiful men. When Stooges touring gets done, I start working on the third opera with him about weird kind of mix, you know, between those little drawings and the Hieronymus Bosch paintings and my theory, or a theory I've kind of took a hankering for about maybe a coming in age thing where Dorothy, trying to figure out the weird dances that guys do. Myself not accepted. Accepted? Am I accepted? No. Accepted. I've not been accepted. whatever. I should tell you, after Jack Flanders, we heard Super Inuit, something live by Holy Fuck, and then something else live by Keiko Ueda called Bird of the Universe, and then Mountain Mystery by Helios Creed. Now, I've chosen that song to do for a Helios Creed tribute in the next year. And I dig him a bunch. I have much respect. Got to do some gigs with him years ago when I was with Edward and Georgie. And then I saw him again a few years ago, not too long ago, a couple tours in Lawrence, Kansas. And I know he lived for a long time in San Francisco, had that band Chrome. And I'm very honored I was asked to come aboard. I hear some more music.
You're calling us heathens with zero respect for the law. But we're only songwriters, just writing our songs, and that's all. We write what we live, and we live what we write. Is that wrong? If you think it is, Mr. Music Executive, why don't you write your own song? And don't listen to mine. They might run you crazy. They might make you dwell on your feelings a moment too long. We're making you rich. And you were already lazy. So just lay on your ass and get richer, or write your own song. Mr. Purified Country, don't you know what the whole thing's about? Is your head up your ass so far that you can't pull it out? Getting smaller, and everyone in it belongs. don't listen to mine. They might run you crazy. They might make you dwell on your feelings a moment too long. We're making you rich. And you were already lazy. So just lay on your ass and get rich. Write your own song. So just lay on your ass and get rich. Write your own song.
Motherfucking bar on a Monday night are the people that just can't live without alcohol. You know what I'm saying? Mondays and Tuesdays, the days that normal people like you and me spend rehabilitating for the typical 72-hour binge that we put ourselves through every weekend. Monday night. These Monday motherfuckers just don't know how to slow down or regroup. They may look at Wednesday afternoon to catch a few Z's before gearing up for the weekend, but Monday nights they know they can get the whole bar to themselves. It's just me and them. So I put up with a lot of bullshit, and that's what it is, just bullshit. Liquor is like truth serum. You know what these motherfuckers are really made of. Most nights these motherfuckers are just in here talking shit and all of it blends together and you don't really hear any of it. Monday motherfuckers are upchucking their secrets left and right like I'm a motherfucker that they can confide in and shit. They have no idea that I'll turn around and tell all you people all this stuff. But here I am, and here we go. So this is the last idiot Monday motherfucker starts telling me I cheated on his girlfriend and shit, like I'm sympathetic, like he wants me. Like he wants me to have something to do with this shit, like I'm his guy or something. He's all proud and shit. Starts talking about all these different positions. He's cheating with his bitch now. Do his girlfriend. This stuff his girlfriend won't try. Like, I should be impressed by this stuff. 6 tequila shots later, he's giving me his girlfriend's number. He wants me to call her and tell her what a great guy he is. Like, is this guy serious? Shit. Well, I should have some fun with this shit.
The man knows something that you don't know.
That's right, Jack.
The man is clear in his mind.
The soul is mad.
Thank you.
That's right, Jack. The man is clearly talking. He's dying, I think. He hates all this. He hates it. But the man's over. Look at his poetry out loud, all right? And a voice.
Seems to ignore the fact that on this very planet there are still people living in the Stone Age and practicing cannibalism. Primitive tribes of isolated, ruthless, and hostile empire fighting the prevailing law of survival of the best. And this jungle, which its inhabitants refer to as the Green Inferno, is only a few hours flying time from New York City. Well, to remind us of this, the four brave young Americans went there to make a documentary on life in the jungle. Was it also to remind us, for instance, that before venturing into space, we should become more aware?
It's nice to meet you, Professor. Lieutenant here was telling me you're what an excellent guide.
From Pedro Show, that was The Green Inferno by Sunken Landscapes, band out of Long Beach. Pretty trippy, huh? Before that we had Soon by Japan Cakes. I think they used to be around and have reformed. Before that was Monday Night Bartender by House of Cricket. Neat bass. And then Write Your Own Song by Willie Nelson. Start your own band. Write your own book. Write your own poem. Paint your own picture. Write your own song. A little credo. I've been coming up with a few credos. Like, the least bother to the most folks. Mike Watt maybe is best tolerated in a tiny dose. Well, big spiel with Watt and Steven on the phone there, but not a lot on this show. Because I wanted to give the whole thing. The man was very interesting. And I think if you follow his story, I mean, he got into music through his pop, but the way he took it and all the places he's been to get where he's at, and like he was saying, you know, him and Wayne and the Lips, Michael, they can play whatever they want. They're not stuck in that genre side crap, you know? And we need liberating folks like that to give us confidence, I think, because otherwise we're just marketing ploy, tool, cliche, clown, whatever, controlled by things other than the heart and the passion, you know? So I wanted to have all of Steven's spiel there. And it's trippy, him calling himself young with me. I know he is younger, but I don't know. I don't know. I always see him as contemporary. Maybe because of Brother Wayne, because he definitely is. But such an honor for me to have him, have Mr. Steven take time out. You know, he's raising two kids with his wife, and he sounds like the happiest father, very much into the voyage of bringing on the next shift. I have a lot of respect for him, you know, doing that. Sometimes, I guess I do it with the songs. A little bit. Anyway, God, it gets me to thinking, you know. And my mind starts wandering about that. But at 50, I don't think it can pause too much. I have to be intent. And deal with what's realistic, what's real. And maybe get out of my dream world, the dream picture. They seduce me, or I seduce myself with them sometimes, but I need a little bit to get on with the work, the reality. Anyway, we're getting at the end here of the April 27th, 2008 Watt from Pedro show. Keep your powder dry.